It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolfarth. As the light comes back this time of year and the snow piles up deeper in the mountains, South Central Alaska becomes one of the world's best places for backcountry skiing. There's an incredible feeling you get from this sport, which goes beyond what you get from hiking. Touring on skis, obstacles disappear that would stop you in the summertime. And if you're into thrills, you can make your own, climbing up and skiing down some extraordinarily beautiful terrain and setting the challenge at the level you can handle. But there's lots to know to get into backcountry skiing, which with the range of techniques and styles that are in a state of change in recent years, and we're going to learn all about that today and about the joy of the sport with our guests, both avid backcountry skiers. And Adam Verrier is with me, and Adam has kind of become a regular on Outdoor Explorer whenever we talk about skiing. He's a former Olympian and an avid backcountry skier and a surfer, and we're just joking that he may end up taking over the show if I'm not careful. Thanks for being with us, Adam.
Thank you for inviting me again.
Yeah. And Toby Schroer is a academic at the Institute for Social and Economic Research, but he's here today because he's an avid backcountry skier and has skied in Europe and here in Alaska. And Toby, what is the essential thing about backcountry skiing, about skiing off the trails that, you know, attracts you, or what turns you on about this activity?
Yeah, thanks, Charles, for having me. I came up here from Europe. I grew up in southwestern Germany, and Alaska was just too big of a country to pass up on the way to ski. Backcountry skiing is just a way to travel in Alaska, I find, and it's just a beautiful way to experience the landscape,
yeah,
what it can offer. And it has a lot to offer around here.
Yeah. Adam, we've talked about how, although you're a super fast skier, you like to just sort of take off across country and just sort of see where you can go.
Yeah, my first experiences skiing were when I was in grade school in southern New Hampshire, just going out behind the house. And I think that's backcountry skiing, going out in the woods. And I'd find there was a gravel pit that was about 3/4 of a mile away, and it had some really steep stuff on it. And I could go out there with my little cross-country skis and just bomb down that. And, when you asked me to be on the show, I started thinking, what is backcountry skiing? Backcountry skiing, I think, really is any skiing that doesn't involve a groomed slope or a prepared, you know, dealing with the elements that you see out in the wilderness.
Yeah, I mean, if you think about it, it's really probably the original essence of skiing. When the first people started putting boards on their feet, they weren't like going on a Kincaid groomed track or down an Alyeska slope. They were just sort of like, this is a way to get across the country.
Yeah, and I think that skiing, both in cross-country skiing, alpine ski jumping, and some of the other specialized sports, skiing is getting so specialized now, and people are sort of selecting an aspect of skiing to get involved with. But I really would like to think of myself as a ski meister, somebody who does everything. I saw this video a year or two ago with Laird Hamilton, who's a great surfer, and he was talking about how he wanted to be good at stand-up paddling and surfing huge waves and surfing small waves and be a good kayaker and a good swimmer and a guy who could go underwater for a long time. And he called himself a waterman. And I thought, that's what I would like to be as a skier, as somebody who can snowboard and telemark ski and alpine ski and cross-country ski and do all these. Give me a pair of skis and hopefully I can get around on it proficiently.
Yeah, I guess for me it's like this, the joy of being outdoors in the sunshine, in the snow, and light is just hitting your body from every direction, and there's a certain euphoria to being out there in the mountains, whether you're just touring or if you're going down a big hill. And then I think, you know, looking around and seeing the sort of the virgin snow is also a really special part of it, you know, that you have the feeling, you know, you're not the first one to go there, but you sort of have the feeling of being an adventurer, being out beyond the end of things. Yeah,
there's an element of discovery, mm-hmm, for sure, and there's a lot of beauty outside, and yeah, it's nice to be able to combine experiencing that beauty with going really fast over snow.
Yeah,
you know, and you were talking about discovery. Toby is a guy who is a real adventurer and is always looking to discover what's over the next hill, and
yeah,
it does
so
some
Toby,
amazing
tell
trips.
Us about how did you? I mean, Adam told us about skiing in the backyard. I'd be more or less the same story, though. I think my parents dragged me up to Arctic Valley when I was probably 3 years old. To start skiing.
Yeah, this is exactly how it started with me. And in my early years, me and my brother, when we still had snow in southern Germany, we used to make big jumps out, on my grandparents' hill, and we were jumping off of those hills, and it just came with. It was the tradition of the family to do those things. My mm-hmm. grandparents used to ski on wooden skis, and they would always, in their old ages, tell us how great of an experience it was, how to go around in the local woods and go out for a ski tour on the weekends. And the same thing with my parents. My dad was a slalom skier. When he was younger, and he showed us how to ski, and we just learned it on, basically in the backyard on the hill where we had our house on. So
mm-hmm. it was in the air. I don't think I'm old enough to be your grandparent, but I learned to downhill and cross country ski on wooden skis too. Yeah. So what is your ideal of like a perfect backcountry skiing trip, Toby? I mean, do you go out just what do you like to do?
I think for myself, I really like to go out multiple days on longer trips that take me into the more remote parts of the state. I like to be going with people, mm-hmm. Friends, and have a really good time. And doesn't matter how bad the weather is, and it will be a good experience when you come back.
Uh-huh. What are some of the expeditions you've done?
I guess... One great trip I was just reminded of was in the early days when I first came up to Alaska. Adam invited me to go with him on Alaska to go on a spring ski tour across on Alaska.
Oh wow! And, the Aleutians.
And uh-huh. So yeah, that was really a spectacular place, very exotic for me.
No trees to run into.
no bears, no, none of that. And still enough snow to ski across passes and down into really remote fjords of the island, which is beautiful. Mm-hmm. And not many people get to see that.
People don't realize how beautiful the Aleutians are. You know, when the fog lifts, it's like the most gorgeous place. Just so gorgeous. Yeah.
And I think the Aleutians also have some great volcanoes that are skiable.
Nobody thinks about skiing the Aleutians. That's a new idea for me.
Yeah, people have done that. My friend Chris Flowers has probably skied all the volcanoes along the chain.
Amazing. So, Adam, you were talking about sort of the classic backcountry ski from Anchorage is Turnagain Pass, drive down Tin Can, you come back and have a beer at Girdwood, like you're saying.
Yeah.
I mean, there's nothing wrong with that. That's pretty fun.
No, there isn't, for sure. Yeah, but I think sometimes... I don't know. There may be there's a lot of creativity that can go into a nice backcountry trip. And so the easy sort of default trip from Anchorage is you go up to Hatcher or you go down to Turnagain and take a few runs. And that's probably the trip I take more than any other trip also. But I really think that the ideal of backcountry skiing is about discovery. Although one difference may be in style between, like Toby really likes to take adventures where he goes into places where I think Toby doesn't always know if he can get from one point to the other. And so he's going to have to solve some problems like how to get over a mountain on the way or something. Whereas I'm typically content just to be out in the woods or in the mountains.
You're going out to find a mountain, ski down it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's enough for me to find something where I can ski really, really fast through deep powder and crank off some huge turns, and I'll call that a success.
All right. Well, I mean, let's fill the listeners in on why you would want to use your muscle power to ski up a mountain, to ski down it, when you could use a personally nice ski lift at Alyeska and pay your 40 or 60 bucks and do it all day long and probably do it like many, many more times during the day.
Yeah, there's an aesthetic to it that I think is maybe difficult to quantify or to describe, mm-hmm. but certainly, you know, there's the silence of the mountains which is, I think, the reason that people, you know, we leave the city to get out into the mountains, and skiing in the backcountry is a way to access that and see that there is there's more going on. I was up in the Chugach Range a couple of a couple of weeks ago, and we were skiing with my friend Danielle Lesko, and we were skiing across an area, and all of a sudden these two ptarmigan came one after another came popping out of the snow. I think there were two or three of them, and they just came out of nowhere. So I didn't realize ptarmigan sleep or rest underneath the snow like that. There were no tracks. They had gotten there before the snowstorm, which was the day before. I'm not sure what was going on, but these are the sort of mysteries you start to figure out when you're out in the mountains.
Yeah. So. It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth. We are talking about backcountry skiing today with Adam Verrier and Toby Schroer, who are the relevant fact about them, as you may have figured out, is they're both avid backcountry skiers. And somewhat different styles or approaches, but a lot of enthusiasm for the sport, and trying to let listeners know, well, why would this be fun? What's awesome about it? And then we're going to get into some of the different techniques and styles and equipment, and we're going to talk about places to go and also talk about how you could learn to be a backcountry skier. And of course, there's also the safety issue, avalanches and getting lost and rescue. We've covered that on some past shows, and I've posted those shows on our website at alaskapublic.org. We did a show just recently on Alaska Mountain Rescue, and earlier in the year we did a show on avalanche safety and the classes you can and should take before you head out in the backcountry on your own. And then back in the fall we did a show about snow itself and how some of the science behind snow. So we're really into snow on this show, and we're into safety, but today we're talking just more about the fun of it and the joy of backcountry skiing. So this is really the time of year, isn't it? You know, when you get some daylight, because during the short days of the year, there's just not enough time to do that much with your... Oh, you're shaking your head. Toby, I mean, what's your favorite time of year? Or do you ski all winter long?
I think all winter long is really the best time. Maybe the best of the best is certainly in the spring when the days get longer, and the longer the days are, the longer you can stay out and do your activity and get some good exercise. Mm-hmm. I think the aspect of having a really good day is also having a really good exercise, and it just feels very satisfying and very... Yeah, it's just something to skin up a mountain and ski it down rather than taking the lift all over and over and over again, skiing with hundreds of other people and having powder to yourself.
Yeah. There's a skill to skiing powder, and obviously people who are into it, that's like the thing that they want to do. But it's a real skill on like staying, you know, it's more like surfing than it is like skiing on a groom trail.
But it also helps, new technology really helps us out. And there's, for example, the tip of the ski is now, there's what's called an early rise that's basically is taking the front of the ski, the first third of the ski further back and lifts it up. So you got a much longer tip. Effectively, and that really allows you to deal with some variable conditions like breakable crust, skiing over it easier, and also the width of the ski allows you to stay up and float better. And so I think technology really helped us along the way to make it more forgiving for beginners to backcountry ski.
I think it is a lot easier to learn to ski now than it was back when I was a kid.
I first moved here in 1992, and at that time, I didn't see that many people skiing in the backcountry. There were, and there had been people skiing in the backcountry long before I got here, obviously. But there weren't that many. I think it has a lot to do with technology. We were skiing on relatively narrow skis at that time. And the skis have gotten to the point now where I have a pair of skis that's something like 150 millimeters wide and 2 meters long, and those things will go through anything. I mean, the new skis.
A lot of surface area to keep you up on top of the snow.
Yeah, and the skis have made it so that everybody looks like a good skier, and everybody can ski like Ted Ligety through any conditions, and it definitely wasn't like that 20 or 30 years ago.
Yeah, it's fun when you ski with somebody who learned to ski back when I was a kid and sort of stayed with that style, legs tight together. Sort of a very graceful look. I mean, it actually looks a bit prettier, the old style, than the new style where your legs are farther apart and you're sort of, you know, as I say, carrying the beer down the mountain, right? So let's get into equipment and techniques. The classic backcountry equipment was a telemark ski where the heel is not attached, and you do this telemark turn where it's sort of a crouching one leg goes way in front of the other. And occasionally you still see people doing telemark, but a lot less than you used to. Toby, what are the reasons why telemark might be becoming less popular and people are moving to different equipment?
Yeah, I think one reason is that, well, there's this notion of fixing the heel, fixing the problem. If you get your heel locked down, it's a little bit easier to ski. It's not as wobbly. You don't have to really put equal pressure on both the hind leg and the front leg. Mm-hmm. Although it gives you a great workout for your legs that way. Mm-hmm. And it's just a different way of skiing. I still love to ski that way. But for an all-round application that really works in almost any condition, in almost any terrain, if you lock down your heel, you get a much more out of it. In addition to that, the new technology with bindings like Dunafit bindings are really super lightweight and they're releasable. So if you're in an avalanche condition, if you're in an avalanche accident, mm-hmm. Your skis may release and they don't drag you down.
Even in the case of a fall.
Right. Exactly. Also, mm-hmm. in case of a fall, it's a lower risk mm-hmm. associated with releasable bindings compared to the old cable telemark bindings. So telemark bindings have also evolved to be releasable, but the new technology on telemark bindings is really not as weight conscious, mm-hmm. I would say.
Adam, are you seeing a lot fewer telemark skiers out there?
No, I personally am not. It seems like there are people who really like telemark for their reasons, and there are people who like alpine setup for their reasons. I do both, but I don't currently. I don't own a pair of modern telemark skis at the moment because I prefer the feeling of an alpine. I like making those kinds of turns, big mm-hmm. high G-force turns instead of telemark, which is a little different. It's a little different sport, a little different feeling.
It's a very sort of graceful. It seems like it's a slower style. I mean, you're coming down the hill slower.
Yeah, although I'd hesitate. You know, I'm sure that there would be telemarkers who would say, no, absolutely not. I guess I would just say that it's a different style. And it's a, there's a certain type of turn that I really love making, mm-hmm. which is a high speed turn, which has a certain technique to it. That's a different turn than a telemark turn. And I know that there are telemarkers who feel the same way. They would say they'd want to be on telemark skis at least 95% of the time because they mm-hmm. enjoy that feeling. And I also, I like snowboarding because I think, in my opinion, in like waist deep light powder, skiing is not, it just doesn't compare. Snowboarding is just dreamy.
Really?
In certain conditions. Oh yeah.
Why?
You've got so much surface area and there's this sort of, for me, it's sort of a semi out of control. I say that when I'm on skis, I'm the one who makes the decisions and the skis do what I tell them. And on a snowboard, I feel like the snowboard decides where to go and I just follow that thing down the mountain. And it's just this sort of float down the mountain.
But you're a surfer too. So that's like, you're into that.
Yeah. Although I'm not a very good surfer.
All right. Well, I think, you know, a lot of listeners might not know what this alpine touring equipment we're talking about, also known as randonnée equipment, which is essentially it's a like a downhill skiing binding that you have on a rental ski or whatever at Alyeska, just the normal, except that the heel can disattach. And so you can ski uphill as well, maybe put some, probably put skins on the ski, so which are, fabric attachment that essentially gives you a large degree of friction, so you can ski up very, very steep pitches, and it's usually sticky on one side and has straps, so you can strap it on your ski. So you have this ability to ski uphill, but it's not exactly like skiing in a touring boot. Because it's a big, heavy boot, probably, right?
No, even the new four buckle alpine backcountry skiing boots are fairly light.
They're lighter.
Partly mm-hmm. made out of carbon, and mm-hmm. And the insoles are also fairly light. So mm-hmm. Equipment becomes more and more.
It's getting better all the time. Yeah. I may be behind the times, but it's not. I mean, you wouldn't want to like it would if you wanted to go touring. If you wanted to ski a long distance on the level, would you use that equipment or would you switch to like a touring outfit?
Yeah, I even have a pair of my ski touring outfit, which I call ski touring because that's what I use if I go on a trail on across the Resurrection Pass or into the South Fork of Eagle River. I got a narrow pair of skis that has a three-quarter metal edge. Mm-hmm. It's really, really light, and it can be waxed, so mm-hmm. I can wax it. And it's not really a wide downhill ski that you would mm-hmm. you would take going up and down a mountain. So it's more of an across the country type ski. And I leave the heel free, and I have what's called a front piece of a Dunafit binding in the front, and a normal, really lightweight ski touring boot that's stiff, mm-hmm. and it allows me to even skate ski with it, and even do classic mm-hmm. because it has some flexibility in the toe, not as much as a Telemark boot, but still a little bit. So there is now variation of really all the different components, and you can fit it to really exactly fit your need.
Yeah, I guess when I was critiquing my experience in the alpine touring or running equipment, it wasn't so much the weight, but the stiffness, because as somebody who spends a lot of time classic skiing, track skiing, the ability to flex my foot feels very important, you know, and suddenly to have this sort of the toe hooked in there and this rigidity feels funny. I mean, do you have that experience, or maybe you spend so much time in the backcountry that it just seems natural to you?
Yeah, it's a very natural way after a while, and you wouldn't go back after trying it out.
Adam, I mean, you want to weigh in on that?
Well, yeah,
stiffness.
Yeah, I must have 5 or 6 or 7 different setups for different types of backcountry skiing or more extreme skiing or ski touring that I might do, and I might get to the parking lot to the place where I'm going to start skiing before I decide which one to pull out of the car and use, because I have a Scarpa, a pretty light Scarpa boot with a Dynafit binding, but I find that I broke a boot last year. I've had the boot flex. It's a softer boot, and I've flexed the Scarpa boot in half where it just about has hurt my ankle a lot. And mm-hmm. I've come out of those bindings when I haven't wanted to sometimes. And so when I'm going to ski something really fast, I'd rather use, I have something called an Atomic Tracker binding, and it basically fits an alpine boot. And that's a lot heavier, and it's quite a lot of weight to haul up the hill. But mm-hmm. then you're in an alpine binding with a, you know, din setting goes up to 18. And so I know I'm in. And
so
I'm not
when you're
out.
Skiing aggressively down steep terrain, you want like aggressive alpine equipment.
Yeah, I like that. But there's plenty of days when I like to use that Scarpa equipment. You know, I may say, well, I want to go further, and I don't want to be in that Atomic Tracker boot all day because it's a big, heavy, uncomfortable boot. But it's got great performance. But the that Scarpa system with the Dynafit bindings is fantastic. But there's other days where I might say, you know, I really want to go a long ways, and I want to use a touring setup, and I've got a pair of skis like Toby with a metal edge, and I might say, you know, I'm going to cross 2 or 3 mountains, and I'm going to have some downhills, and since I like to think of myself as sort of, as I referenced earlier, kind of a ski meister, a person mm-hmm. who can ski on. I think, well, this would be a challenge. I'm going to try and do something really steep on these skis, and I should be able to make it. Mm-hmm. And
it's a technique challenge there, because you're keeping that weight on your heel, even though the heel's not attached, and trying to cut a turn.
Right.
Like on an alpine ski, but you're on a cross-country ski, essentially.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's the same even with skate skis. I mean, Toby mm-hmm. and I, have, most of many ski racers around this area have gone backcountry skiing on skate skis, where you're having to ski down 40-degree slopes on skate skis. And if you're a good skier, you know where to put the weight on the ski.
Remind me not to go skiing with you.
Yeah. I like to challenge myself in a little different way than Toby does, maybe. Like I said earlier, Toby likes to see if he can get from one point to another through an interesting, intriguing route, I think. But
yeah, I want to talk about that in the second half when we get into talking about places to go, because it sounds like you've done some amazing trips. But so do you have like a light touring set that you ski with, Toby? I mean, are you into that, or you just find the Dynafit is just what you want?
Yeah, like Adam said, you know, we all tend to have multiple skis, multiple different bindings, multiple different boots, and they all fit a certain purpose. And that's what I have. I have a pair of, you know, skis that are wide and long and have a Dynafit binding on that I like to ski on when I ski in Turnagain or Hatcher Pass or on the road system. And then I have a lighter setup that I like to go on longer and maybe high altitude kind of trips. That's more of a ski mountaineering setup. It's a shorter ski. With it, I can ski much more narrower chutes or things like that. Mm-hmm. And then I have kind of a much more narrow and lightweight kind of pair that I like to take across Rest Pass, for example.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, it's
so three different kinds do it for me.
And if you have enough money, you could have all the skis you want. But I mean, every one of these sets of skis, I'm just hearing the numbers go cha-ching, cha-ching, cha-ching.
No,
I like the idea, though, this idea that you should be able to ski. You should be able to have one pair of skis, to own one pair of skis and be able to go and do all kinds of things.
Yeah.
And you can. I mean, people have been doing that for long before 10 or 15 years ago when a lot of this new technology came out.
Yeah. I mean, we're talking to two elite skiers here, but in terms of the sort of the middle of the road skier, somebody who's going to ski a backcountry, you know, maybe a few weekends a year, because that's really all we can get away for. What do you think is the basic equipment?
Well, I got one of my touring skis for $5 at the ski swap.
There
and
you go.
It's a pair that would get you throughout the whole winter and you will have fun on it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, for $5, you're with it. And a couple more dollars for a pair of boots that fits it, and then you go.
You have to know what you're looking for, though. Take a buddy along to the ski swap. Adam, what do you think is the best all-around ski for somebody who can't really afford to buy all the different
stuff? Right. If you were looking, well, first of all, buy the stuff used, because mm-hmm. the stuff that's a few years old is plenty good. But if you were, I think you sort of were referencing maybe somebody who might go to Alyeska and want to go backcountry skiing also, and they make some really nice, fairly soft skis that have a binding that hinges, and the whole binding attaches to the boot, and it works very well at the ski resort, but it hinges and you can go in the backcountry. I think Marker makes a binding like that,
mm-hmm.
and it's a pretty solid, reliable, pretty heavy duty Alpine binding. But you can go in the backcountry just fine with it. You know, Dynafit is much it's lighter, but you know, you don't need to own two or three pairs of skis. One should do it.
All right. It's Outdoor Explorer, and we are obviously talking about backcountry skiing today, and had a really fun discussion about why we enjoy doing this, and then got a little bit technical there on different types of skis and equipment. Hopefully didn't scare everybody off. In the second half, we're going to talk a bit about places to go, and then maybe some tips for how you could get into this sport if you're a beginner. But right now it's time for the Outdoor Explorer calendar. The 2014 Arctic Winter Games kick off March 15th in Fairbanks. The annual week-long sporting event includes traditional winter events like alpine skiing, curling, and biathlon. It also includes indigenous events like the one-foot high kick, the Alaskan high kick, and the Neil jump. Participants from several different Arctic nations will compete, and for more information on the Arctic Winter Games, visit awg2014.org. In Anchorage, Fur Rendezvous is currently underway and will continue through Sunday, March 2nd. Weekend events include the Running of the Reindeer, an outdoor ice hockey tournament, and the all-new Waiter and Waitress races. For more information on these and other great Fur Rendy events, furrendy.net. It's the big weekend of the year. The Iditarod Trail Sled Dog Race, the last great race on Earth, kicks off this weekend as well for its 1,000-mile journey to Nome. Ceremonial start happens downtown in Anchorage at 10 a.m. on Saturday, March 1st. The restart is Sunday, March 2nd in Willow. For more information on the Iditarod, visit iditarod.com. And of course, the Tour of Anchorage, the biggest Nordic ski race of the year and one of the biggest in the country, is starting on Sunday as well. So this is sort of the peak of the winter this coming weekend. Finally, we have Brianna Sullivan on the line with us to tell us more about the Alyeska Snow Classic, which is a contest for guessing the amount of snow that comes down over the winter. Hi, Brianna.
Hey, Charles. Thanks for having me on today.
You bet. So tell us about the Alyeska Snow Classic. What's it all about?
Well, the Snow Classic is similar to the Indiana Ice Classic. I'm sure many listeners are familiar with that, except that we differ in that the players are guessing the depth of snow at a certain spot on Mount Alyeska. So the guessing game can be a really exciting and fun way to win money, because the snowfall, we don't know what will happen between now and the date. And the reading date is April 27th, and the guessing is all in March.
Okay, so you have the month of March in which to place your guess. I guess waiting till March 31st might not be such a bad idea in that case.
Right.
So, and you're guessing the amount of snow that falls, or are you guessing the amount of snow that's on the ground at that date?
On the ground at that date. And it's over 1,000 feet is where the stake is mounted. And what people will do, will buy tickets for $2.50 each at local Girdwood businesses, and then they can fill in to the feet to the nearest hundredth how deep they think it'll be.
Oh, wow.
And we're in our second year. So last year was our first year, and we're still small, but we're hoping to grow. And it is a fundraiser for Four Valleys Community School. So 50% of the monies will go to the winner, and 50% will go to Four Valleys.
Okay. So did you, have one winner last year? I mean, with if a hundredth of a foot, it's pretty fine distinction.
Right.
I would think that would be hard to measure.
I know. It can get really tricky. And we actually had two winners last year, so they split the pot. And both had the exact guess.
Which was? What was the correct guess?
You know, I don't have it with me, but it was over 8 feet last year.
Ah, yeah. So it's been a weird year for snow. I mean, was it like a really bad year for snow? and then we finally got some. So I guess.
Yeah, we had a dump last week. So you never know what can happen. We'll just pray for snow and let it snow.
How does it look for skiing this weekend down there?
Looks pretty good. We had some sun today and spring skiing conditions and great visibility. So it's always a good reason to get out and have some vitamin D.
Yeah, that's right. All right. So if folks want to buy tickets, Girdwood businesses, I'm sure at the resort, $2.50 each. And do you have a website?
Yes, we do. AlyeskaSnowClassic.org to find out more information and where to buy tickets. And, you can get 10 for $25 and have way more chances to win and for a good cause. So
all right.
It's a fun way to get involved.
Okay. Well, thanks very much, Brianna Sullivan, for being on with us, telling us about the Alaska Snow Classic. And she gave you that URL if you want to learn more about it. But you can also find web links to everything we talked about on today's show, all the items on the Outdoor Explorer calendar at outdoorexplorer.org. Now stay with us for the second half, and we'll continue to talk about backcountry skiing when Outdoor Explorer continues.
You are listening to Outdoor Explorer from KSKA Anchorage. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and iTunes. To see what's coming up on future programs and add your voice to the conversation, go to alaskapublic.org.
We're back. It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth. We're talking about backcountry skiing today, and my guests are both expert backcountry skiers, Adam Verrier, who has been with us many times before and also went to the Olympics as a Nordic skier, and Toby Schroer, who is a social scientist, but he's here with us because he's a skier. And I thought we were just starting to get into talking about where to go. There's obviously spots near Anchorage for various levels and abilities, and even places you can go if you only have 3 or 4 hours, you know, up behind Flat Top. Let's start with that. You know, Adam, do you want to talk about sort of the selection of places that you like to go, given, you know, the amount of time you have and how steep a terrain you want to ski?
Yeah, I think just the fact that the Alaska Avalanche Center runs a daily avalanche forecast for Turnagain Pass and the Summit Lake area down on the Kenai Peninsula, and there's also a daily forecast for Hatcher Pass, indicate that those are some of the most popular places to go. When you go down there, you see a lot of people. And there's an obvious reason for that. It's not too far away. I mean, an hour will get you to both those places. Mm-hmm. And the skiing is accessible right off the road. So mm-hmm. I think any mountain town. I think it's the same in Colorado or Utah. Sort of has its places that are easy to go, and everybody goes there. So they're getting pretty crowded. Back in '92 when I moved up here, it could snow, and then you'd have 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 days. Maybe you'd go skiing, and then you'd come back a few days later, and your ski tracks would be the only ones there still, or maybe one or two other people had gone. You'd wonder who those people were. And now you better be there within about 8 or 10 minutes of the snow stopping, because it's going to get tracked out immediately. Mm-hmm. So there are some advantages to going other places, but those places are...
And why is that spot, why is Turning Pass so popular? I mean, is it just because the steep terrain near the road?
Yeah, you can get out of your car and not have to go up through any trees, any forest. Mm-hmm. You can, from the top of the pass, you can go right up Tin Can Peak or up some of the other mountains, Manitoba, Sunburst, and you basically just start going right up from the car, and your last turns are 100 yards away from the car. So mm-hmm. it doesn't require this long approach through the woods or over a mountain range to get to where you're going.
Mm-hmm. Same thing with Hatcher, just park right there at the... In the bowl?
Yeah, you can drive way up into the alpine terrain. I mean, you go above treeline halfway up the pass in your car. Mm-hmm. So by the time you get out of the car, you're in the alpine terrain.
What about that area right behind Flat Top? What's that called? Peak something?
Yeah, there's Peak 2 and Peak 3, mm-hmm. which I think a lot of people, especially in the spring, go there after work. Mm-hmm. And so that's got a variety of people are hiking on it with their running shoes, just going for exercise. People are bringing their dogs for walks up there. People are sledding on it, drinking beer up there, backcountry skiing, going mm-hmm. snowboarding. So,
but
it's a great place to go really close by.
And then for touring, we were talking earlier, I guess may have been off the air, about Arctic Valley to India, and that's a very popular tour trip, I don't know, maybe 20 miles or so that you can easily be done in one day.
Yeah, there's that trip that can be done in a day, but there are a lot of other, you know, Resurrection Pass is a multi-day trip that doesn't require any skill except the skill to, you know, be out in the woods for a few days, maybe even staying at cabins and not, mm-hmm. not get frostbite or something. But there's no mountaineering involved in that one, and there's plenty of other places. I think there's a lot of places down in the Kenai Peninsula where nobody else goes skiing, really, and you can just go into the woods and discover your own. I think that's one of the beauties of backcountry skiing is discovering your own places. And sometimes a trip isn't, you know, it's not the most exciting place, but the fact that you were the one who went out there and did it makes it your own. Mm-hmm. That was your trip, and you go over Arctic to Indian, and you kind of, if you've been over it a few times, you know what's there. There's not a lot of discovery there, but if you pull off on the side of the road someplace and see a mountain you don't know what it's called, and put your skis on and try to go over it and see what's on the other mm-hmm. side, that's pretty exciting, I think.
Let me ask a question that will betray how low my skiing ability is compared to you guys, which is that when you're coming down Arctic to Indian and you're coming down the Indian part, you're skiing pretty narrow little twisty trail between trees. And that's true actually of a lot of these sort of touring locations, that there's the end part, you know, could have a steep bit. I mean, how do you ski those narrow trails? I would probably just take my skis off a lot of times.
Yeah, I think a lot of people do take their skis off, and there's no shame in that. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's no point in trying to ski down some icy thing that's going to send you into a tree and hurt yourself. You know, you're trying to skitter down this thing if you don't have the skills for it. Mm-hmm. I grew up skiing on that. You know, I'd mentioned at the beginning of the mm-hmm. show, I started skiing just out in the woods behind the house, just sort of going down between trees. And I think when you spend a lot of time, as much time as somebody like Toby or myself has spent on skis, they're pretty natural on your feet. You don't really think about it. You just move them where they need to go to get the job done. And mm-hmm. so I ski down that. I like skiing pretty fast down that stuff. I think it's fun. But
I'd like to watch you do it so I can figure out how.
But there are strategies to get down there if you're mm-hmm. a little timid, mm-hmm. Which includes snow plowing if the conditions allow you, or just to make really long, wide turns if you can get through the woods. If there's room.
If there's the ability for long, wide turns, I'm okay.
and side slipping, in my mm-hmm. opinion, side slipping is the best tool for the backcountry. I think that there are a lot of, I was thinking about someday trying to do this trip called the Haute Route, and it starts on Mont Blanc in France and ends over in Zermatt in Switzerland. And I read a guide, a brochure from some guides that said, if you you need to have a good side slip to do this trip. And I thought to myself, yeah, the side slip is the way, the side slip is the way you get into steep couloirs. Use expert skiers. I mean, there are some guys that have basically side slipped down Aiguille du Midi in France, which is all basically cliff. They say they've skied it, but if you watch them, they just sideslip the whole thing. Mm-hmm. And having a good sideslip is a great tool, and you can use it even going Arctic to Indian, coming down that side where it's icy. You just sideslip down that stuff, and it works out
great. And that's something you can practice when you're skiing at Alyeska. It's not rocket science.
For sure.
Just figure out how to keep going when you're going sideways. Yeah. So, Toby, tell us about some of the Adam's been building up all these cool traverses and trips you make. Tell us about some of your adventures, and how do you go about setting up a multi-day trip? I mean, you especially if you want to do something exotic or that you don't know somebody else who's already done it. How do you make those choices?
Yeah, I think what it comes down to is really planning well as you can. Sometimes you don't have the time to plan well, and then you're still going, and you may end up turning around due to weather or due to poorly preparing for the trip. But as it happened a couple times, we had to turn around was on a traverse. We got inspired by some idea to go from Portage to Grand Lake in Moose Pass to go across five glaciers, starting at the Burns Glacier.
Wow.
And then over across Black Burn, Spencer, Snow Glacier, Trail Glacier, all the way across and coming out Grand Lake. And we tried it for, my wife and I tried it from both directions a couple times until the weather really fit and we really had it figured out. And it just takes some time to look at Google Earth where you can go through.
Oh, that's a great
Google
tool.
Earth is a great tool. And an additional tool is what the wife Darcy, she works for the Alaska Ocean Observing System, and mm-hmm. they have a real-time sensor map that basically shows you the temperature and wind conditions of all the weather stations across Alaska.
Right, and you sent us a link to that, and we've got it on alaskapublic.org on our site. Yeah,
and also gives you webcams and all the information on weather that's currently out there across Alaska, including some really local weather models that allow you to get good forecasts, localized forecasts on winds, mm-hmm. Winds as well as temperature conditions. And we used that for our successful traverse on that part, which
how do you use weather forecasts? I've learned over the years that I want to be advised by the weather forecast, but I often don't want to cancel a trip because of weather forecast, because they're just not accurate enough, and you're as likely to get out and find, you know, cancel the trip and find out the weather was great as to be turned around.
A good way to get a good sense of how certain they are in their forecast is reading the forecast discussion.
Mm-hmm.
And
that's
that sometimes reveals more or less uncertainty about the forecast.
Right. If you go to the forecast office website, they'll have a discussion there on the left-hand side. Yeah, it is. They'll tell you all models in agreement. Then you might go with it. But if they say, well, we're not too sure, then you sort of like be skeptical of it, right?
But if you're really into it, the AU's website that's on mm-hmm. now, the link to your website too, is really offers you some models that are not, you know, or if they are, really hard to access through the NOAA website. So,
right. So that must have been an amazing trip. How long did it take you to do that from basically from Portage to Moose Pass?
It took us a day and a half.
Oh, not so long. Once you got the weather, it wasn't too bad, huh?
Yeah.
And some steep slopes on that trip?
Not too many. There's a couple steeper slopes up on when you ski down the Grand Lake, mm-hmm. Through the woods there from the pass. But other than that, it's pretty straightforward.
So I got to get you guys to tell me about, I mean, you're making yourself sound so awesome here. And I actually got an email from Jeff Rust. Is that? And he says, bold claims by Adam. Toby is German, which makes him crazy. I know you guys have had some falls and mishaps and things that don't always go right. So, Adam, you can go first. You have to come clean.
Yeah. Well, I was telling telling Toby earlier that I don't take so many risks as I used to, and part of that is because I had a couple of near misses. I think when I was about 17 or 18 years old, I fell from the top of Tuckerman's Ravine in New Hampshire one time, and I grew up there, and it must have been more than half a mile of went over a couple of cliffs, and I went from the right down the center of the headwall, which was 55 degrees. I made a classic mistake on the first turn and fell, and then went all the way to the bottom. And
did you know how steep it was and what the risks were?
It was a lot. It was I just didn't lean out over the hill far enough. I was intimidated, and so I just the skis kind of got stuck in the snow, and I got back on the tails, and I started sliding, and I thought, oh, this is really, really bad. And I came out of it all right. I didn't get hurt. It was fine. But
wow.
And I had a couple other. I had another fall. Down in the Snowy Range Mountains in Wyoming when I was going to college there on Medicine Bow Peak. That was another one of these things where I went basically from the top to the bottom of a long couloir, must have been a quarter mile or more. And after those, I started thinking, you know, I don't really need to take risks so much.
You got pretty lucky.
Yeah, I got lucky not to get hurt, and both of them turned out just fine. But it sort of made me reflect on what was important to me. And I think that I am a lot less of a risk taker now, and I tend not to ski on exposed terrain because it's not anything that it doesn't reward me much. If I succeed, I'd rather just find a big snowy bowl that's very steep. And then the other way that I prefer not to take risks is with avalanche. You know, you do the snow stability assessment the best way you can and try to choose the best line. But some people, I think, are a lot more willing to get closer to the line than I am. I'd rather have a big, big buffer between. And so for me personally, I just, having seen some avalanches, not having ever been in one or even being really close to being in one, but just seeing them start and see them run several thousand feet out to the bottom of a mountain.
The power and speed of it.
Yeah, it makes me think, I don't ever need to be a part of that.
Yeah, so when you see a big bear like do something aggressive, you realize, oh, okay, now right. I get it, right? So, and listeners should certainly be aware that everything we're talking about comes with the proviso that you need to have avalanche awareness, you need to know what you're doing. And we did a whole show on avalanche education and what you need to know, which is linked on our website at alaskapublic.org. Just click on today's show on backcountry skiing and you'll find that link. Lots of information there. Also information from a show we did recently on backcountry rescue, all really important. And in Alaska, it's really your responsibility. There's, as we learned on that show, if somebody has to come rescue you, there it's a body recovery. They don't come and get live people out of the snow. You and your companions need to self-rescue an avalanche because you won't live long enough for somebody to get there. And that's the bottom line. So if you don't know what you're doing, you don't have the right equipment, you shouldn't go out. But, you know, if you're with somebody who knows what they're doing, they can help you learn. So that's the plus side.
Yeah, and for a beginner, I would suggest that the best way to get into this sport is to find somebody to go with who is not going to bully you into doing more than you're comfortable with. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of fun to be had in flat terrain and very low angle terrain. And there's avalanche courses. Like there must not be a week that goes by where there's not an avalanche course run by experts in this town. Now, there's plenty of experts around. I think, it's a matter of choosing, dealing with sort of figuring out how much risk you want to take, which for me isn't much of any risk at all. And especially, like I said, starting out with somebody who's not going to intimidate you into doing more than you want to do.
Yeah. Toby, how do you line up on that risk scale? How much risk are you willing to take? And some people, I think, are extreme skiers simply because they like risk.
Right? Yeah, it's interesting. The more experience you have, the more risk you're probably willing to take. And that is not really a linear relationship. It goes up and down over time as you become more experienced. And I think if you do have an incident, a really serious incident early on in your career, it may actually end up on the confidence scale way, way low, too low, maybe considering the experience you have. And then over time, that slowly rises up again. But your confidence level never gets to the, at least that's what the theory says, never gets to the level where it used to be in early years. Mm-hmm. So if you're, you know, not as experienced, there's really issues with overconfidence.
Yeah, well, and where do you put yourself? I mean, skiing, the rule I always tell my kids and I wish that more people told their kids, is you have to be in control all the time. I mean, if you're skiing, you need to be in control.
Yeah, but there's always uncertainties that you have to deal with, and they relate to the snowpack, they relate to the terrain, they relate to the human factor, who you're skiing with, and also they relate to the weather. And if you keep those always in check and check whether each one of those is either a red bullet for you or a green bullet for you, and then sum them up at the end, then I think you're most of the time on the safe side. If you mature enough to recognize your limits. I personally am on that risk scale. Well, I'm a little more of a risk taker, I think, than Adam is in this sense. I like to push it sometimes, and so that's how you. I think there's always a certain level where you need to be willing to take risks in order to do those trips, in order to get to the summit and ski down, if you have that objective.
So give us an example of what pushing it means. I mean, it means like skiing a mountain nobody's skied before and you don't know the terrain exactly. But what does it mean exactly when you say that?
It means that sometimes you may feel a little uncomfortable because you're right at the edge of, okay, I feel comfortable, or I'm right not comfortable right there. And just it's a process of gaining more experience.
Okay, I know what I know what you're talking about, because I'm in there frequently when I'm downhill skiing, because I'm not that good a skier. But there's this sort of feeling of, okay, I'm on the edge of my abilities, and then you get to the bottom and you feel great, and then there's this feeling of, I'm getting a little beyond the edge of my abilities and I'm scared and I hate this, you know. So I mean, it sounds like you don't often go over into that other line.
I don't like to go there.
Yeah, but that happens, right? And you never know when it's going to happen. You go over a bump, it gets a little steeper than you expected. Adam, you're nodding your head.
Well, yeah, I can think of many examples where I, and not recently, but earlier examples where I did something and I was on the edge of my ability levels. And when I got done, I looked back and I thought, I'm not glad I did that, you know. But I know other people who really are glad they did it. I grew up, I went to a ski academy my senior year of high school, and was in school with a lot of people who then went on to be in a lot of ski films, like the TGR films, doing extreme skiing and jumping off big stuff. And those guys love it. And I know that they really enjoy the feeling of, you know, Jeremy Nobis has told me several times that he really loves the feeling when you say, you're thinking, oh, I can't do this, I'm going to die for sure. And then you do it and you pull it off. He says, it's awesome. It's the most great thing. And I think, no, I don't personally really enjoy that. I just have a different personality. And also, he gets paid to do it, and I don't.
Yeah. Well, and I always wonder about the ethics of that, you know, that I mean, there's a sense of, yeah, you get a thrill, but do you have a right to throw your life away in order to do something that really is so dangerous that, you know, your family is going to go through losing you, and sort of society's invested in you? I don't know. There's a mountaineering, you know, there are those mountaineers and extreme people who go out because it's fun and it's meaningful for them. But then there's others who seem to be almost at the point of death defying. And that I kind of question, just on like, what's that all about? And I'm not sure that's right. I don't know. I'd like to hear from both of you. I know a lot of people feel very differently about that.
Yeah. Oh, I think there's a wide range of opinion on that. I saw a movie recently that probably a lot of listeners of this show saw called McConkey, which I thought was a fascinating movie. No, that's a difficult question. That I think there's a whole range of ethical and moral questions there. That it's a deep. That would be a deep topic.
Yeah. What do you think, Toby?
Yeah, it's hard to say. I find it, you know, there's certainly you can have if you're out there, you make decisions all the time. And it's, if you're traveling in a good group that has good communication and communicates about risk, then you have the ability to have multiple perspectives on it, which really allows you to reduce that uncertainty. And as I think it also means to have really good habits, have habits of going with people that you know their ability. Know about the terrain, the snowpack, and the weather, have your safety checks in place when you go. Before you go, you check your beacon. You check whether everybody has a shovel and a probe, and knows how to use them. And then also as you move up the mountain, and this is the beauty of ski touring and of ski mountaineering, is that as you move up the mountain, you familiarize yourself with the environment. You familiarize yourself with the snowpack. You learn by going up the mountain how the snowpack looks. And once you're at the top, you should know at least a little bit more than when you started about mm-hmm. the snowpack. So, you know, you can make some informed decisions that way. And if you share those in the group, everybody goes up and they make mm-hmm. little, with a ski pole, test out the snowpack. You go and maybe dig a pit and look at it. Mm-hmm. And just reduce that amount of uncertainty. You can really deal with risk. So it's a human component.
It's taking the risk very seriously.
Oh, and then you always very seriously, mm-hmm. and taking the communication about mm-hmm. risk seriously. Mm-hmm. I think that's an important part too, because if you don't communicate about it, you don't make a decision that comes from all parts of your group, mm-hmm. which can be detrimental in some place.
Yeah. Well, we've just got a little bit of time left on Outdoor Explorer, and we talked. We sort of interspersed the beginner topic. Look for used equipment. There's good used equipment out there at the ski swaps in the fall, and also probably at the used shops around town. You need to find somebody who knows something about skiing before you choose equipment to make sure you get the right equipment for you. Try to find somebody who can help you. There's also lessons available. I mean, other things we can throw in for people who are not intimidated by our discussion now and think, hey, I'd like to give it a try.
We have excellent ski shops here in town, mm-hmm. and the staff at a couple of ski shops in town really know what they're talking about, mm-hmm. and so that's a great resource.
And one additional resource people really need to know about is the Arctic Valley ski lifts, which really offer you a great starting or practice playground for ski touring, because they have limited grooming. And they have the terrain that a lot of people that are starting off are just not easy, not mm-hmm. too easy, but also not too hard. But it gives you a real good backcountry skill playground right there. And it's affordable, and it's right there in Anchorage. And they got better view than Alyeska, I think.
And it's it doesn't get a lot of use, a lot less use than Alyeska. Right. I suppose you'd have to go on their website and find out when they're open and stuff. Alyeska is usually groomed pretty quickly. I mean, if you want to ski on powdered Alyeska, you have to be there like a minute after it snows, right? Mm. Although part of this is spending some time on the lifts and getting your skiing ability before you sort of go out and you're relying on your friends are relying on you and you're relying on them in the backcountry. Sort of being a decent skier.
Yeah, but the ski technology that they have now is the skis are so much easier to ski on than mm-hmm. than the comparable skis of 15, 20 years ago, for sure.
Yeah, so it's a good time to get into downhill skiing if you haven't done it. And wow, what a great sport. And I thank both of you guys for being here today. This has been an interesting conversation. I've actually learned quite a bit. It's made me realize we should do a show on the ethics of risk taking in the outdoors, because that's a good and heavy topic. My guests today have been Adam Verrier, who is a former Olympian and all around athlete and outdoorsman, skier, sort of become our skiing regular here on Outdoor Explorer, and Toby Schroer, who's a social scientist with the University of Alaska and also a very avid backcountry skier, has done all kinds of trips. Brianna Sullivan was with us earlier to talk about the Alyeska Snow Classic. On next week's show, our topic is Alaska Native Games. The annual statewide competitions are coming up soon, as well as the International Arctic Winter Games in Fairbanks. These games are mostly done indoors these days, but their cultural roots are for preparing for outdoor survival and hunting success. We'll have athlete and cultural experts in the studio. Thanks for joining us today on Outdoor Explorer. Our producer is Monica Gokey, and I'm your host, Charles Wolforth. I'll see you at the Tour of Anchorage this weekend, and I'll see you outside and next week. Thanks.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Theme music is by Portugal the Man. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Outdoor Explorer and listen online at alaskapublic.org.
Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.